Blog Talk Radio.
Sometimes in our fast-paced world, it's difficult to imagine our communities of the past. Historian Rui Santos detailed an average trip by horse and carriage from Boston to Plymouth, Massachusetts in the 1830s, lasting some 10 hours. 50 years later, a new form of transportation would take center stage, the bicycle. And it was during that period, between 1880 and 1900, that the intersection of race, athleticism, and cycling came to new forms of freedom and expression. Lawrence Fennison's remarkable new book, Boston's Cycling Craze, paints the landscape of how a host of visionaries took to the streets and byways, all for the glory of the bicycle. Black, white, Asian, and biracial. They are all in the book and all chronicled in detail during those pioneer years of cycling. Come explore with us as we turn back the clocks to the golden age of bicycles, during the era worth noting in the annals of American history. Hi, this is Carol Copeland Thomas, and you're listening to Focus on Empowerment. Hello, my friends. This is Carol Copeland Thomas. I'm glad that you're listening. We have those listening in the chat room, those who are going to be listening live, and those who will listen after the fact. This is going to be a really interesting show. It's a kind of book that you wouldn't really think about, but boy, you just start turning the pages and you say, there's a lot to this, and there's an awful lot when it relates to multiculturalism. So we're going to bring our guest on in just a few seconds, but I want to turn your attention to my books. We're actually having specials going on with my book, 21 Ways to Bring Multiculturalism to Your Job, Your Home, and Your Community, and a bonus book, Real Women, Real Issues, that I wrote. And you have a chance to get both books for the price of probably one book, one and a half book, with another special gift offer. And if you go to my website, tellcarole.com, TellCarole.com, you'll find out all the details about how you can get those two books shipped to you, and you'll be reading, and I think the information will be very, very helpful to each and every one of you. So I encourage you to go there and find out more about it. And thank you to those who have already taken advantage of this special offer that will end on April 22nd. Well, as I said, I have a very special guest on and received this book, wanted to support him because his wife and I just pretend like we're cousins because of our name Copeland and a possible lineage. She's a famous Boston media personality and has been on the scene for many, many years. They have one beautiful daughter. And so I got the book, and I wanted to support for that purpose, but I said, oh, this looks interesting. I like history. This will be an interesting read for me. But then I dug. I said, wait a minute. This has everything to do with the work that I'm doing in terms of multiculturalism and a period of time with Boston that many of us are not really familiar with and how it relates to the bicycle and the importance of the bicycle. So I want to bring on a very special guest who has been in Boston for many, many years. He's the principal of a public health consulting firm, Sigma Works, and a cycling expert and passion for him. This is his official name is Lawrence Fennison, but he's going to allow me to call him Larry. Hello, Larry. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Carol. It is a wonderful opportunity to be on your show, and thanks for that great introduction. Wow.
Well, I'm excited about the book, and again, the more I read, the more exciting it gets. I want you to paint the picture, and I talked about Rui Santos. He's a historian who I literally met last night. I went to a historical talk about Edward Everett, who was a famous politician, theologian, and gave a 1 hour and 57 speech during the Gettysburg period, and he spoke for 1 hour and 57 minutes before Abraham Lincoln gave his historic speech. So during Rui's conversation last night in discussion, he talked about the fact that transportation from Boston to Plymouth took 10 hours by horse and carriage, literally. And so I was just sort of looking at that time period, and then 50 years later you have the bicycle that had been invented and had been shown off with exhibitions. So tell us how significant it was to have a bicycle where an individual could own a piece of equipment like this.
Well, it was tremendously significant, especially from the point of view of people being able to get out of the city. What's not that well known is that Boston was a pretty dirty and decrepit city in the 1880s and 1890s. It was filled with all kinds of slaughterhouses and smoke and smells, and people delighted in getting away from the city. Well, how would they do that? They might hire a horse and carriage or have one. But if they didn't have that, then a good way to go might be to get a bicycle and cycle out of town into the more rural areas, and you could have a wonderful day out kind of exploring nature on a bicycle, completely under your own control rather than as you would on a train.
I'm sort of equating it with those who now have personal cell phones, where you have the freedom and the flexibility of communicating with someone without being tied to a landline and the explosion of it. So I sort of look at it in the same way in terms of how bicycles were so popular. Well, I want to go back to that early time period, and there was a famous exhibition, and then somehow Boston really caught on, and it just caught on fire. Tell us about that period of time.
Well, it really did catch on fire in the late 1870s. Bicycling started earlier in England, but came over here with great force, and one of the seminal events was an event called the Wheel Around the Hub of 1879, 2-day trip around Boston and down to the South Shore and back again. And one of the big things about it, a long story about it was published in Scribner's Magazine, which was kind of a highbrow magazine at the time. And that really kickstarted bicycling across the nation. It became enormously power. And Boston was really in the leadership of bicycling for the next two decades.
Right, right. There was an organization started and founded here, the League of American Wheelmen. Tell us about that organization.
The League of American Wheelmen was a national organization, and the early leadership of it and the editorial work of their journal and magazine all came out of Boston. And it was a very powerful organization at the time, and it spawned a movement called the Good Roads Movement that sought to improve the roadways of the time. Unfortunately, in the 1890s, some of the southern delegates to the organization decided it would be a good idea to have a color bar to ban all black cyclists. And they were able to push that through in 1895 against the wishes of many of the Boston cyclists, and particularly of the black cyclists in Boston, who held a number of protest events during the time.
Right, right.
And that whole story is told in the book.
Yeah. That also led, I believe, to the formation of the Riverside Cycle Club. Is that correct?
That's right. There was an all-black cycle club called the Riverside Cycle Club, and there were probably 25 or 30 members of it, and they bicycled together, but also bicycled with some of the other clubs of the time. There was a kind of an ambivalent relationship, let's put it that way, between the white and black cyclists of the era. And sometimes they would be excluded from events, and sometimes very much welcomed to the events. One of the cyclists of the time, Kitty Knox, who is a kind of central story in the book.
Tell us about her. I wanted to get to her. Before you talk about Kitty Knox, she's a central player. You've actually dedicated the book to her. I wanted to just paint the stage for those who are listening who just may get their history a little mixed up, but this was on the heels, this was on the backdrop of the Civil War, which ended in 1865. Then you had Reconstruction, where you had many schools to start in the South, many black schools to start in the South. There was like a rejuvenation and a renaissance period in terms of growth and development. So this was like on the back side of it. The Reconstruction period lasted for maybe 8 or 9 years, and then things started changing, as you have depicted in terms of the color bar and other things that took place during this time period. But one of the central figures was Kitty Knox. Tell us about who she was and why she was so significant during this period.
Well, Kitty Knox was born in 1875 and was significant in a number of ways. For one thing, she was biracial, and it's not well or widely known that that was a fairly common thing in Boston of the 1870s.
That's amazing.
And it amazed me when I found out about it, but it was not uncommon during that time. And
that's significant. I want you to go on and talk about her, but the significance of that is when you look at the miscegenation laws, particularly in Virginia, there's a famous case. Obviously, they went to the Supreme Court in the 60s, but it was illegal for blacks and white to marry in certain states, but certainly was not the case here in Massachusetts because her white mother and black father married for a period of time. Correct, Larry?
That's correct. And then they lived in the West End of Boston, and she joined the Riverside Club. And she was a seamstress. Her father had been a tailor, and she became a seamstress and made her own bicycling costume, with which she won a contest out in Waltham on July 4th of 1895. There's a big bicycle contest out there, and she was one of five women who exhibited their bicycling costumes, and she was declared the winner. And particularly because of the style of skirt that she wore, which was not a long skirt, although some of the people in the audience hissed because they thought the long skirt was the only way to go.
Right, right.
So she was an interesting character, and then out of that, she went down with a bunch of her Bostonian comrades to Ashbury Park, New Jersey, for the League's annual meet, and she protested there against the color bar that had been recently enacted, and was welcomed back to Boston with open arms. So she was quite well known around Boston and quite popular, indeed, around Boston.
And
she came back later on in 1895.
Right, and certainly set the stage for so many. First, I'm thinking about her costume, innovative with their visionary, won contest, went, she was an activist, a protester, but sadly she died very young. What happened with her in terms of her life being cut short?
We don't know very much about her except that she died of kidney disease in 1900. So she was still a very young woman when she died, and she was buried over in Mount Auburn Cemetery in an unmarked grave. And a wonderful story to tell is that about 2 years ago, her mother's side of the family, some of the descendants that I was able to find, actually raised the money. That was the Toll side of the family, raised the money to have a marker put up on her grave at Mount Auburn Cemetery. And we had a wonderful service over there during that event. So I'm very pleased with that. Pleased with the Toll family, who were really quite open to commemorating their long lost and really until the book, unknown aunt, if you will, Kitty Knox.
That's amazing. That is really amazing. And during that time period also, there were several clubs that started. We talked about the League of American Wheelmen, the Colored Club, the Riverside Cycle Club. Tell us about the Chinese cyclers. Again, this is the multicultural aspect of it for me is just fascinating. So tell us about some important key players who were Chinese or other ethnicities.
Well, the one Chinese American I was able to find was Henry R. Foon, who was the president for a while of the Chelsea Cycle Club, which was called the Winnisemmet Cycle Club. the ancient name for Chelsea, and he was the president of it. An interesting story about him is that when the Boston papers announced his presidency, one of the officers of the club wrote in a very angry sort of way saying, no, Henry was not Chinese at all. He was totally assimilated.
Oh, boy.
And that was the whole message of the time, was that you were okay if you were totally assimilated. They said he didn't even speak Chinese. So it's a very interesting story in itself. There's another wonderful Boston story in all of this, which is the great African-American cycling champion whose name was Major Taylor.
Yes.
And he was actually part of the very first fully integrated professional sports team in America, which was the Boston Pursuit Team of 1897. And he and Eddie McDuffie, an Irish-American, were both on that team bicycling together.
Right.
As I said, in the first professional sports team in America. And the other interesting story about them is that a year later, they were featured in a matchup against each other,
right,
which was promoted by the race promoters as a match of black against white. And that, to me, is a very interesting piece of it, how they were both on the same team together and cooperated and then competed against each other as vociferously, and that's how the promoters chose to feature the race as black against white.
And you actually have a picture of the button that was created in 1898 with this famous race on the Charles River Park featuring Taylor and McDuffie. Again,
I have a picture in the book of that button, and was able to purchase the actual button just about 4 days ago at a bike auction up in Copaic, New York.
Wow.
I'm so glad to have it in my possession.
I see sequels to this book. I mean, because there are lots of legs here and just lots of great information. What's the message here? Again, For me, as someone who loves history and likes to bring out history in the work that I do, the significance is astounding. It's a lot of history. We talked before we came on the air. I know the West End because of Charles Street AME Church. I was a member of that church and part of that church for many, many years before joining Bethel AME Church. So they started out in the West End. So what's the significance, first of all, of the West End of Boston during that time?
Well, the West End of Boston was really the second home of African Americans in the in Boston. First home was a part of the North End, which was called Little Guinea, and then the second home was the West End, which was not too far away and really down the backside of Beacon Hill. So it had a very significant aspect in that regard, but it was also a very integrated neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Because of all the new immigrants that were coming in from Southern Europe, Eastern Europe, Italian and Jewish immigrants all coexisted in that neighborhood. And then basically the African-American neighborhood changed and really moved to the South End and then ultimately to Roxbury. So one of the lessons in this is that neighborhoods in Boston never change. They're always moving, and the people within them are always moving.
And here you have a mode of transportation. Obviously, people were walking to and fro. You had streetcars. But to have this individual vehicle where you can get from point A to point B relatively quickly, I thought was probably quite empowering for those who needed to get to work or needed to get to school or just wanted to have a stroll in the countryside when they had an opportunity. Tell us about the laws, or at least the practices that were in place, where a lot of the races did not take place on Sunday. Why not?
Well, there was an argument about that within the towns and within the state legislature and within the cycling community itself, whether it was a good idea to do racing on Sundays. And some of the preachers were very much against it because they thought it would take their parishioners away from the church and send them out into the countryside. Some of them actually adapted to it by providing early services so cyclists could come to the church, park their bicycles, go to the service, and then bicycle afterwards. There were also some that were very much against Sunday racing for a kind of class-based reason, and that is since a lot of the working class in Boston worked 6 days a week, it was felt that they would come to the races on Sundays, if there were races on Sundays, and the races would be spoiled because there would be a lot of gambling going on. And a lot of these sort of working class people and some of the upper middle class cyclists didn't really like that idea. So they were against Sunday racing, particularly in the South, but also to some degree in the North as well.
Mm. This was also a great explosion. We've already talked about Kitty Knox, but just the role of women in key leadership roles in cycling. Can you share with us information about Abbott Bassett and the where do I have it in my notes? The Wheel Woman, that publication. Talk to us about that.
Well, Abbott Bassett was an early tricyclist, and he tricycled along with a woman named Mary Sargent Hopkins in the 1880s. Eventually, he became the editor of one of the big cycling magazines of the time, one of the league magazines of the time. And he was very supportive of more cycling by women. Mary Sargent Hopkins started publishing The Wheel Woman in 1895, right on Tremont Street in Boston. And she published it for at least 2 years. And she was a very strong proponent of women cycling, but paradoxically, she was also a strong proponent of the long skirt and found it very difficult to get away from that, although eventually she made some concessions to the practice and designed what she called the Sargent Hopkins adjustable skirt, so that a woman could shorten the skirt to ride the bike, and then once she got off the bike, she could make it longer again and for proper walking costume. So she's a very interesting character in all of this. Daughter of a Lynn shoemaker. And I tell her whole story in the book as well.
Right, right. And for those who are outside of Massachusetts, Lynn, Massachusetts was a very important industrial city. Lots of immigrants were there. They were able to come with no skills and get work. We had shoe factories there. So when you look at cities in and around Boston, including Lynn, Massachusetts, that was a very prominent one during that era. What does this say about that 20-year period, 1880 to 1900? What does it say about America? What does it say about women's rights, people of color? Why is this, I think, an important era in our country's history, Larry?
Well, I think that one of the things, in terms of people of color, what it does is to illustrate that there was a certain period after the Civil War when people had great hopes and that there was tremendous advancement on the part of African Americans in this country, and particularly in certain areas like the Boston area, but also to learn that that period was pretty short-lived, and things began to get worse and worse starting in 1890 and really going on beyond that. There were much more in the way of exclusion, or at least attempts at exclusion, and much greater struggle around that. So one of the lessons of history to me is that, I'll use this expression, some people say that the arc of history bends towards justice. I would say, yes, in a way that's true, but on the other hand, there are many hiccups along the way. It is not a straightforward process at all, and it really depends on people who are willing to get out there and struggle.
And
so that's one, to me, one of the great lessons is that things can go backwards as well as forwards, and we need to always be vigilant about that.
And never forget history. I mean, this, again, gives us a sense of the cyclical nature of freedom and liberty and some levels of camaraderie, followed by Jim Crow and the awful lynching that obviously took place in the early 1900s and beyond. But this was a very, very interesting period and a very special period in Boston. Your book is published by the University of Massachusetts Press. How can people get a copy? Let us know, because I'm sure people will listen to this and they'll say, I want a copy of this book and read it for myself.
Well, I think they can go online and get it from UMass Press. I believe it's on a number of the other common websites. But I would just Google Boston Cycling Craze, and that should get you right to the publisher so that you can purchase a copy of it online.
Absolutely. And this has a personal meaning for you, certainly when you look at Kitty Knox. Share the personal connection that you feel. Obviously, you're a cyclist, but tell us more about Larry and why this was such a special project for you.
Well, I think it was a special project for me in part because I discovered early on the character of Kitty Knox, and that she was biracial, and being in a biracial family and with a biracial daughter, it just kind of grabbed me. I mean, her story, even without that, would have grabbed me, but this grabbed me with a special urgency, and I thought her story just absolutely had to be told. And then to discover members of her family who had pictures of her in an old scrapbook, I was completely hooked, and I thought, you know, I've got to get this thing published, and I'm very thankful to UMass Press for helping me along the way and getting it out on the street.
That's great. Your ethnicity, share with us your ethnicity, because I'm curious about your last name, Finneson.
Well, Finneson is actually a kind of anglicization of sorts of an old German name, Finneisen, and that was my German family name from the period of the 1840s and 50s when my family came to America. So my family is English, Dutch, and German.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of my own background.
That's great. And your wife is a beautiful African-American woman, too. And your daughter is gorgeous. I've seen her many times. And so it's a wonderful family. And I can see the connection that you would feel toward Kitty Knox. And I'm glad that you've had a chance to meet her descendants also, or at least some of her family, her extended family members.
I am so glad. And I guess in all of this history, we can see how mixed up we've all become in terms of our ethnicities. That's the constant.
Yes. And have been for many generations, and you certainly have brought it up very well in your book. This is a great book, Boston Cycling Craze, 1880 to 1990. We've been speaking to Lorenz Finneson, otherwise known as Larry Finneson. Great book, lots of research, and if you care anything about athletics or athleticism and that whole combination of the bicycle and an era that we need to learn more about, this is the book for you. Larry Finneson, thank you so much for being a guest on my program.
Well, thank you very much, Carol. It's been a delight talking to you.
Great. All right. Larry Finneson is the author of Boston Cycling Craze, 1880 to 1900. It's a really good book. Again, you look at the cover and you say, looks pretty interesting. But then you open it up and you read an awful lot. It pertains to Boston, obviously, but the significance of it were clubs like the League of America Wheelmen, National Club, also clubs like the Riverside Cycle Club, the Chinese American gentleman who headed another club. Lots of multicultural connections here during a period of time that was very important in the shaping and the molding of American history. So I would encourage everyone to check out the book. You can also download this program. It'll be on my blog, and you'll be able to listen to the interview and pass it on and share it, particularly with younger people, those who are into health and fitness. They can learn a lot about health and fitness and how it shaped the economy and shaped how people went about their lives during an era that maybe they don't know that much about. So this, I think, is a very intriguing book, and I think will ring true for many, many people, regardless of where you live. Thanks so much for listening to the show today. We'll be back with another show next week, and I hope you have a great, great weekend. This is Carol Copeland Thomas, and empowerment begins when you believe in yourself. Talk to you soon. Bye.